The Guardian.
This podcast is sponsored by audible.co.uk, the number one online destination for digital audiobooks.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Richard Lee.
Die Verwandlung von Franz Kafka. Als Gregor Samsa eines Morgens aus unruhigen Träumen erwachte, fand er sich in seinem Bett zu einem ungeheuren Ungeziefer
verwandelt. El proceso. Franz Kafka. Alguien debió haber calumniado a Joseph K., puesto que sin haber hecho nada malo, fueron a arrestarlo una mañana. La cocinera de la señora Grubach, su patrona, que cada día le traía el desayuno hacia las 8 de la mañana, vino esta vez.
Comment Candide fut élevé dans un beau château et comment il fut chassé d'y celui. Il y avait en Westphalie, dans le château de Monsieur le baron de Thunder-ten-Tronck, un jeune garçon à qui la nature avait donné les mœurs les plus douces. Sa physionomie annonçait son âge.
В мире 21 века на фоне новой расстановки экономических, цивилизационных, военных сил Россия должна быть суверенной и влиятельной страной. Мы должны не просто уверенно развиваться, но и
London stands at the center of one of the world's great publishing industries, with more than 200,000 new titles published a year. Fueled by a surge in self-publishing, our cousins across the Atlantic crank out another 350,000. The world is awash with English literature, more than anyone could ever hope to read. But what about the rest of the globe? As our lives become ever more networked, ever more international, the splendid isolation of Anglophone letters becomes ever more apparent. Latin American literature may have boomed with Carlos Fuentes, Gabriel Garcia Marquez and Mario Vargas Llosa in the 1960s and 70s, but by the turn of the millennium, only 2% of the books published in the UK started off in languages other than English, a figure which translates into only a couple of hundred novels a year from the world outside. But there are signs of a resurgence, with a wave of bloggers, small presses and independent publishers who insist on the value of the view from elsewhere. The percentage of literature published in translation is even beginning to creep upwards, point by point. So I've come here to a blustery Hampstead Heath, with an east wind coming straight off the Russian steppe, to meet Christopher Maclehose, a publisher who's championed literature in translation for more than 3 decades, and who is celebrating 5 years at the helm of his own specialist imprint, Maclehose Press. Hello.
Good morning.
Hello, Mishka. I see you've got your nice warm boots on for today.
I need warm boots today. Yes.
We've got snow here falling down gently. How does Mishka like a nice blustery walk?
He loves snow. He's very happy in snow. But he just, what he can't stand, why are we waiting, you say?
I thought I might start by asking how you started specialising in literature and translation.
I was first a publisher. We're talking several decades ago. There were still 10 really good publishers who were emigres from Europe. The one I worked for was called Leopold Ullstein, from the great German publishing house. And he had a Russian wife, and it was the most natural thing in the world.
It was just something that you did as a matter of course.
Something they did. I was learning. Mishka.
And so it's just something that you've always continued to do. Have you had to stand up for the importance of matters from elsewhere?
American literature was the dominant force, I think, in the 70s and 80s. And if translated literature is coming back, I think in part that is because maybe American literature is not so all powerful. I don't think that really great writers need to be confined to a very small part of the world. I mean, obviously they come from everywhere. There were times, in the times of the Icelandic sagas, so far as we know, when the bulk of the best storytelling was done in one small island. But that's no longer the case. And all over Asia and India, and of course Latin America, are writers of the first rank. And I think you have to go and find them. And by the way, I think that there has grown. There are many more first-rate translators now than there were when I started. There wasn't work for them.
And what do you attribute this flowering of translation skills to?
It was that really good editors were to an extent frustrated by the way that the gigantic groups of publishers were going. And they wanted to be freer, more independent, and in that independence to look for writers to translate. More and more and more small houses are involved, and more languages too. Publishers are, I mean, famously, they're all sheep. So Umberto Eco wins a huge audience here, somewhat against the grain, I mean, to his publishers. Astonishment, it has to be said. I think he imported 2,000 or 3,000 American printed copies with an English jacket. And then, of course, the book went on to sell hundreds of thousands of copies. I'm talking about The Name of the Rose. Immediately after which, publishers go in platoon force to Italy to see what they can find. It was the same after The Leopard was published. And when Peter Hoeg, the Danish novelist, published Miss Miller's Feeling for Snow, publishers were off to Denmark. And I can't tell you how many Danish writers were then discovered. I mean, they'd been writing wonderful books all this time, but nobody had been looking there.
I was wondering, do you have many languages yourself?
No, I read French happily. And I have a French wife who reads perfectly Italian. But there grows up around a publishing house a group which I have been very privileged to hang on to, of people who read for you, whose judgment you trust, and who read obviously not only the language, but have read all the literature, which is why for years I said we couldn't possibly have a translator of less than 70 years old, because how could they know the literature? Of course they can know the language. And I think they would all say that maybe 16% of the work of a translator is the language. The rest is the literature, what it is that... I mean, you can't imagine anybody whose English was perfect, who didn't know any English literature, translating The Wasteland. Couldn't be done. They would have absolutely no idea what he was talking about. The original translation of Miss Miller seemed, in the author's view, to have missed totally the tone and the rhythm of what he was doing. And somewhere there exists, I don't think I have it anymore, or even a copy of it, he wrote on the translation an entire new novel, all the way round and through the lines of every single page. And I gave this to the translator, who said, well, that's of no interest to me. He doesn't know enough English. Well, of course, he knew English very, very well, and he knew enough to know that his sentences had been turned back to front, and that upset him. So there are two different translations, one American and one English. Mishka, bien? Hello, old person. You look very much like a polar bear, you do. Yes, a little cold, isn't it?
Christopher McElhaugh's there, enjoying the delights of the English spring on a blasted heath. McElhaugh's press publishes in, as he puts it, only 19 languages.
He says he has no firm plans to acquire any new territory, preferring to wait instead until the writers come to him. One of the writers who has already made his way to MacLehose's door is the French novelist Philippe Claudel. His latest, The Investigation, is translated by Daniel Hahn. It opens as the unnamed investigator arrives in an unnamed town to investigate a spate of suicides. It is, of course, snowing. After trudging through the deserted streets for what seems like hours and submitting to a registration process which feels like an interrogation, we find the investigator following the hotel proprietor, the giantess, up the stairs to find room 14.
He almost stumbled and fell on the first step, as it was of an uncommon height that went against the unconscious memory of his stride. The next, meanwhile, was very low, too low, which also confused him and likewise all but brought him to his knees. So from then on he paid very particular attention, in spite of his tiredness, to each of the steps on the staircase, telling himself that, in any case, there couldn't be as many as 50 of them, since having chosen room 14, it wouldn't take him long to reach the first floor. He managed well, and congratulated himself on this, as no two steps resembled one another. A staircase like that had to be the product of an unbalanced mind. The problem was also that the giantess and the investigator had long passed the first floor, and the two of them did not stop going up, up, up. The investigator followed the giantess with some difficulty, gritting his teeth, hauling his suitcase as best he could, taking in each of the floors, step after step, exhausted. The hotel was beginning to resemble an infinite tower, corkscrewing in on itself, which seemed to be trying to pierce the sky like a drill whose raison d'etre is to make holes in a piece of wood. Then, brutally, a thought came to him. Bright, evident, incontrovertible. He was dead. He had died without realizing it. This observation struck him as quite obvious. What other explanation could there be for all this? Maybe it had happened a few hours earlier when he'd got off the train. Maybe he'd accidentally walked across one of the tracks. Maybe a train had hit him, crushed him, reduced him to nothing. Maybe all that had happened even earlier, while he was coming out of the head of department's office, armed with his mission brief. A devastating attack, a cardiac arrest, an irreversible stroke, just after he'd greeted the accountant who was waiting for her cup of coffee by the automatic dispenser, readjusting her hair and her makeup. Or at home, perhaps. In the morning, getting up, even before he'd stopped his alarm clock vibrating, the hand fixed at 6:15 a.m. An instantaneous death, without suffering. A long slide, and then nothing else. Or rather, yes, something. This nightmare, which had to be a kind of stress test, an initiation test, a better kind of purgatory. Somewhere someone was watching him. He was more and more sure of it. Someone was studying him. Someone was going to decide on his fate.
I was a little bit, I think, tired by the traditional novel writing, because I considered, and I still consider, that this old form of literature, the novel, maybe it's unable to speak about our complex world. And in the same times, I was very shocked by the suicide in a big firm, in a big company in France, like France Telecom. Many people commit suicide in the office, you know, not at home, but in office.
Actually right there at work.
Yeah. And it was a big problem of society. And I'm not a journalist, I'm just a writer. And I want to use my words, my sentence, to discover in a metaphoric tale why today some people want to commit suicide, especially in connection with the work, with the work universe, with the film, etc., etc. And step by step, I began to write this novel, but it's not a real novel because it's a re-examination of the novel's form, sometimes realistic, sometimes science fiction, sometimes fantastic, fantasy, etc., etc. I am like people who want to play with a small mouse, you know? And sometimes the writer of the investigation is a less or more a cruel person, cruel people with his one mean character.
Not sometimes at all. The events that happen to the investigator could be taken from a book about Stalinist torture methods. There's semi-starvation, there's cries of anguish, there's threats, there's punishment and reward.
But this experiment, at the same time, it's a metaphor of this work experiment in our films, our companies today, you know, because some manager use the human being like simple items, like simple materials, you know. But in the same time, I'm a writer and I wanted to use my character like a subject of experiment, you know, but experiment in the novel universe, in the contemporary novel universe.
Was it clear to you this was going to be a novel rather than a screenplay?
When I composed this novel, I think I was more screenplayer than novelist, because it was like a write and drawn a storyboard, because I use screenplaying technique, you know, like editing technique, jump cut, and I use different frames, you know, I use different lens. I think it's a real visual novel, visual in the movie mind.
You never make clear the geographical location of the town, but the fictional location is very clear right from the first page. We're in the land of Kafka, the land of Kadare, the land of Krasnohorkai. What's the attraction of this dreamlike Middle Europa at the beginning of the 21st century?
You're right. Kadare, Leo Perutz, Kafka, and other novelists, I'm constantly fascinated since my teenage, you know, by this special mood in Middle Europe between the end of the 19th century and the 60s of 20th century. I like the grey, I like the snow, I like the frozen atmosphere, I like the fog. And for me, it's more easy to imagine stories, novels during the winter than during the summertime. Day after day, it's more difficult for me to understand the way where we're going together. I don't know exactly in your country, but in my country, the dreams are over. And when we vote for president, there is not a very exciting, thrilling, because we are totally sad and full of doubts. Maybe it's the first moment since the French Revolution, there is not a real hope for tomorrow, for the future. And I think maybe it's a sign of very old society. We gave up our possibility to change the world. We are just like an old man, totally alone. This feeling is one of the roots of this novel.
You've spoken already about your admiration for Ismail Kadare. Do you read much in translation?
Yeah, because in France, we are very lucky for literature. We publish a lot of French novel, you know, but at the same time, a lot of foreign literature translate. And when you are a French reader, you can easily read Albanian novelists like Kadare. You can sure English writer, American writer, Brazilian, Norwegian, Scandinavian, Russian.
And you read the whole world.
Yeah. The world come in France with the foreign literature. It's the same things with the foreign movies.
There are about 30% of the books published in France are in translation, but in the UK and the US, because it's tiny, it's about
3%.
One or two, exactly.
I know.
What do you think readers in the UK or the US are missing out on?
I think it's a real windows open to the world when you have the opportunity to read foreign writers. Because if you have only the voice of your country, it's a too short perspective, you know.
You're missing that long lens.
Yeah. I think it's important to open the doors with the music, with the literature, theater, movies. And when do you live? It's not the case for me in the UK, but when you make a travel in America, in US, especially in deep US, you know, you realize that a lot of people never read a foreign book, never read a news about another country, never listen to music from France, Russian, etc., etc. I remember a strange question in South Carolina, in Alabama, in Texas sometimes. Some people ask me, do you have electricity in France?
And we're opening a few of Philippe Claudel's windows ourselves this week on the book's website, with a series of newly commissioned short stories from around the world inspired by water. We've asked writers from the UK, China, Nigeria and beyond to distill the essence of modern life, to chart the ebb and flow of our cultural existence in stories which range from Buenos Aires to East Yorkshire, from the River Thames to the River Styx. Sarah Hall takes a walk across the Caimans Railway Bridge in Wilderness, while the Argentinian novelist Martin Coan imagines an unusual crossing of the River Plate in The Mistake, translated from the Spanish by Nick Caistor. It begins with the narrator on the docks in Buenos Aires, watching the passengers board the ferry which will take them to the other side of the river, to Uruguay.
I know it's a mistake to let her leave, and yet I do let her leave. What else can I do? I watch her board the ship that will take her across to Uruguay in little more than an hour. The others slow down as they step onto the unstable platform leading from dockside to boat. The strip that's no longer land, but isn't yet water. A floating balance. A sort of aerial transition. But not her. She strides aboard confidently, without stopping. Without thinking twice. As I watch her leave, I wonder if she also knows she's making a mistake. To leave now, like this, it's a mistake. I can't see how to prevent it. I can't see myself jumping onto the ship to save her, still less shouting to her from here, from the quayside, begging her to stay.
The Iraqi writer Hassan Blasim, who like his narrator now lives in Finland, offers a story translated by Jonathan Wright about a man whose past is drenched in water, a man who can't escape the terrible things that happened in the water wars.
That night, the night of the pomegranate orchard, the tiger had been driving the car. He and another killer had to go to a grand house on the outskirts of Baghdad. The house belonged to the boss of a gang, controlling a small river that flowed in across the border. They were transporting the water to areas hit by drought, in tankers and selling it. All the gangs running weapons and counterfeiting banknotes had started trading water. The competition to control the market was deadly. Some of them controlled wells and began to impose taxes on farmers. The government tried to barter oil for water from neighboring countries, but soon lost control. Overwhelmed on all sides by rebels, groups of religious extremists, and then the drought, which derailed bureaucracy already shot through with corruption. The tiger's mission was clear. He had to eliminate everyone in the big house.
Thank you. According to our environment editor, John Vidal, water supply is one of the greatest geopolitical challenges facing the planet. So, John, are the Middle East water wars imagined by Hassan Blasim a realistic prospect?
Well, you could argue they're happening already, that almost the source of most of the Middle East conflict is about water. You can even argue that the Arab Spring was triggered by lack of water in the sense of lack of food. Without water, there is no food, and that is exactly what has happened. What is happening in Palestine and Gaza, absolutely, they're kept thirsty, and that is how you could argue that the water wars have started. It's not just the Middle East, though. It's absolutely everywhere. Two-thirds of the world is expected to live in water deficit areas. In other words, they will not have enough water under UN things within 20, 30 years. The amount of water being needed is greater and greater. And then if you look wider, you see that the water wars are concentrated along rivers. So you have rivers like the Brahmaputra, which start in Tibet, go through China, then India and Bangladesh. China is putting more and more dams along that river. India is getting upset. If India gets upset, then Bangladesh, little Bangladesh at the end with 150 million people, will get no water. And it just needs a 3%, 5% cut in the amount of water which Bangladesh gets. And you have very, very serious problems. And that's why Bangladesh is going to the UN and saying, no, it cannot happen. And you're having 280 rivers are now shared by more than one country. In every single case, there is a dispute of some sort or another. But you could also argue that the water wars are much, much closer to home, that they are more between rural areas and urban areas. So the cities now, where everybody is going, they need more and more water. That means there's less for the farmers. The farmers are getting desperate. So from California right the way to Nigeria and Pakistan and every other country, water is now the commodity which everybody wants a bit of.
And is this a matter of physical geography, brute facts about rainfall, about water flow, or is this also a problem of governance?
Actually, it's both. I mean, you've got the climate change things, you've got increasing droughts, you've got increasing heat waves and whatever, taking up more and more water. And that's only going to get worse. There's absolutely no doubt about that. On the other hand, you're having massive corruption around water. Who owns the water owns the land. Who owns the food has the power. And that is what's happening.
It's an issue which could drive you to despair. The Nigerian author Jekwu Anyegbuna prefers black comedy instead in his story, The Swimming Pool. We can hear a little bit now of what his general Idris Yakubu Haruna made of that during his time in government.
You see, as a cabinet minister in the Armed Forces ruling council, I cherished my water portfolio. I was determined to change the wrong perception then that our water ministry was not viable compared to that of finance, petroleum, works and construction, or even electricity and steel. You may ask what makes a ministry viable. Well, by the Nigerian benchmark, the ministry must have loopholes. Something must leak. Go and ask the former Minister of Finance, who punctured Nigeria's treasury in order to build a world-class toilet in America. Find out from my counterpart in the Health Ministry why he built a cottage hospital at a leprosy camp along the highway, but travelled to South Africa to build a dozen of nothing-is-lacking hospitals. Verify from the Petroleum Minister who set our refineries and pipelines on fire because his private refineries in Canada and Venezuela wanted to sell petrol and kerosene to Nigerians. Of course, my own ministry was a basket of water, and you know, nothing leaks better than water.
Our series launches on the book's website today with a mighty story from A.S. Byatt, who charts the disintegration of a plastic bottle in Sea Story. I was struck by her description of the Atlantic garbage patch, a slowly swirling carpet of floating fragments, all shapes and sizes, some of them in jewelled colours, emerald, opal, crimson, cobalt, ultramarine. But the overall colour was a colourless all-colour of stained whiteness, deathly pale. Have you ever seen a garbage patch up close, John?
Well, I have, and in the Pacific. I don't know the ones in the Atlantic, but they're all very much the same. I mean, basically, these vast collections of waste, plastic especially, which is now swirling around. There are dozens of them around the world. The one in the Pacific is vast, and it covers tens of hundreds of square kilometres.
So it's the size of Texas.
It could be that size. I don't think anybody actually knows. But the point is that the rubbish has to go somewhere. Plastic, breaks down over centuries, not over days or weeks or whatever.
These little nurdles.
They're so small you can't even see. It's microscopic. They're in everything now. They're in the ice. They're in the polar bear. They're in the in fishy. They're in everywhere you look. And it's only getting worse. And there is no sort of solution to it except putting less into the water. The problem has come to us kind of out of the blue. We just thought we could use the seas as our rubbish dump for centuries and centuries, and now we're suddenly realising we cannot. And it's a fundamental point about ecology is that you do not throw away, you do not waste, you cannot waste it. These things have to go somewhere, and they're all coming back home to roost, literally.
It's the brute reality of living on a bounded planet, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it does break down very, very eventually, but I mean, you're talking centuries, and that is not much use at the moment. I think it's also just the waste. It's the terrible, terrifying waste of resources which we're... I mean, plastic can be reused. Plastic comes from oil. You know, we are using the oil in the most stupid way by throwing it away. And when it destroys the fish stocks, when it destroys fresh water, and it gives us the health problems and everybody else, well, it's just impossible to think of. So it's fantastic that novelists are looking in these areas now, because these are the great issues which the next generation and the ones after that will keep coming back to.
Some of the stories take us in even more unexpected directions. Isabel Greenberg leads us into the underworld with a graphic story, The River of Lost Souls. And Neil Gaiman brings the series to a close on the banks of the Thames on World Water Day. But perhaps the strangest journey in the series is the one taken by the Chinese writer Dorothy Tse. Womanfish is translated by Nikki Harmon.
He knows his wife will never be able to tell lies again. All night long, the weary sound of water dripping from the air conditioner slowly eroding into coral dreams. He wakes from the sleep which bore him like an ocean and sees the buildings outside packed cheek to cheek. People squeeze breathlessly through the cracks in the city, looking forward to finding a Christmas tree in the shopping mall, though it's only August. One of the bulbs on its plastic branches has a burnt-out filament, a blind eye amid brilliant illuminations. Outside the mall, the stagnant air has been beached too long. It feels as if all things have come to an end. People look up, and the tight-shut, overcast sky opens its toothless mouth and spatters their faces with rain. He opens his umbrella, and the raindrops pelt down on it like deafening bullets. He seals himself inside his house. The thrumming of the downpour extends to every pane of glass. It doesn't matter how much I wash my eyes, things still get twisted out of shape until I can't tell what they are. I can feel my brain shrinking like a dried-out sponge. Faraway things are too small to make out. His wife's complaints had been fragments of countless lies flowing around his head, fragments he hadn't been able to reassemble into a complete picture. One morning, he realised his wife's sleek, pale head was completely without hair. Her mouth was huge, protruding like a ship cleaving the still waters of the sea. Her eyes had slipped to the sides of her face. Her breasts were two melting glaciers slowly sinking into her body. When she walked naked towards him, all that was left of the woman were her smooth, muscular legs. Apart from that, she'd transformed completely into a fish.
You'll find A.S. Byatt's Sea Story, a love story wound round the Atlantic trash vortex, at guardian.co.uk/books today, with the rest of the series appearing day by day during the week. Just search for Guardian Water Stories. And you can hear more about the geopolitics of water supply on next week's Water Day edition of The Guardian's Global Development Podcast, and read more about vortexes, droughts and disaster of every kind at guardian.co.uk/environment. If you'd like to respond to anything in this week's podcast, you can join the discussion on the Books site. If you've come to us through iTunes or SoundCloud, just search for Guardian Books Podcast or click on the link marked Podcast on the front page of guardian.co.uk/books. There you'll find links to help you subscribe. It's free and you'll never miss another edition. Thanks then to Christopher McElhose, Philippe Claudel and John Vidal. Next week we welcome Claire Armitstead back from her Australian adventure. From me, Richard Lee, and our producer Tim Mabey, thanks for listening and goodbye.
Visit audible.co.uk/guardian audio to choose from a selection of over 60,000 titles. With Audible, you can make more time for books by downloading and listening wherever you are and whatever you're doing.
Downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.